tuatahi a tainui waka tainui tēnā koutou. O tira a tarangatira a tēnā rā koe nau e mihi mai ki tēnei a kia tātou katoa i roto i tēnei piringa whare e tū mai nei. Nō reira mihi mai, mihi mai. Mihi mai kia mātou i roto i ngā tini aitua e pāna kia tātou. Ko ngā tini mat hi ngātu i hinga mai i runga i ngā marae maha o te motu o tira haere rātou. Engari ko tātou nei e te honga ora, a tēnā no tātou. A tēnā tātou i roto i te tino a tāhuatanga o tēnei kaupapa ko te kawenata o Waitangi. Aha koa ngā piki ngā heke. Ko aunei ko tēnei tētahi o ngā tūmanako mō ngā rā e heke mai nei. O tira i roto i nei whakaaro a tēnā koutou. Thank you, Monty, for the welcome and for inviting me to spend some time with you today here. And it's good to see my niece Val here. At least there's one person who'll be able to sing my waiata. if that is required. Good to see you there, Val. And I apologise for the lateness. I can attribute it to two things. I spent the night at Tauranga and missed the turn off to Hamilton and started going to Auckland instead, and realised when I was halfway to Auckland that it was getting warmer when it was supposed to be getting colder. So retrack it. The other reason for the slight delay is to do with modern technology and connecting up the PowerPoint. And we thought we had it sussed, then we realised that all these things are designed so that one system doesn't fit into another system. So that you could never kind of guarantee that all these computers are going to fit in with each other. If you want the biblical reference, I think it's to do with the Tower of Babel. But the issues before us today really is to look at the Treaty of Waitangi so that at the end of the day we won't understand the entirety of the issues, and we won't necessarily agree on all the issues, and that's not the point. The point is that we have a little more understanding of an issue that confronts New Zealand, if not the world, today. And so that's really all that I intend to do, is to introduce you to some of the issues. And I thought I'd do it by talking it initially about the reasons why the treaty was signed and perhaps what the treaty actually says. Then we'll have lunch. Well, it'll take just a little while to do that. Then we'll have lunch. But what I'd quite like to do, maybe during lunch, is just to get some thoughts from you about the issues in particular that you would like us to focus on in the first part of the afternoon. I've got a whole lot of things I'd like to talk about, but I'd really prefer it if there were particular issues you want to focus on, so that when we come back after lunch, we move towards the direction that interests you in particular. So my task this morning then is simply to explain the background to the treaty and what the treaty actually says as a platform for developing other issues this afternoon. So we might just, Monty, have to have some way of collecting the agenda for the afternoon, perhaps around about lunchtime. Now, the other thing I apologise for is that the PowerPoint is not as grand as the one I saw when I walked in here today. It's a small thing. If you can't see it clearly, don't worry too much. It's really a guide for me so that I can remember what to keep on track. And if you can't read the words, they're just really a guide, so that it's not critical. And I'll just put this on here because I'm going to go on the other side, and so I can operate this machine here. Now the
it's not on.
Maybe the other one.
Yeah.
Must be terrible in the old days when they didn't have microphones and videos and computers. But our children, of course, will never be able to remember those days, just as most of us have trouble remembering life without electricity. But the starting point, really, that I thought we'd look at is that the Treaty of Waitangi was actually a compromise. It was, and when we're talking about the treaty, really what we're talking about is the development of New Zealand as a modern state. New Zealand joined the world, so to speak, as a new state in the world in 1840, and the Treaty of Waitangi was how New Zealand became a modern nation. Prior to 1840, it was not regarded as a nation in the sense of having a governing arrangement and being part of the international community. After 1840, that's what it became. And the Treaty of Waitangi was the vehicle which took New Zealand into the modern world. Well, you may not think 1840 is very modern, but it made New Zealand part of the international community. So the treaty is as much really about New Zealand's birth as a modern state as it is about other things. Now, it was a compromise. In 1840, New Zealand could have developed in two directions. It could have developed as an entirely Maori nation. Now, that was on the agenda in 1835. It could have developed as a republic. That was on the agenda in 1839. There was a good chance that New Zealand would become a republic, what some people would have called today a banana republic, because it was going to be done in a ad hoc sort of way, but it could have become a republic. And neither of those things happened, and instead the Treaty of Waitangi provided the compromise between those two options, a Maori nation on the one hand, a republic on the other. And what I just wanted to do is talk a little bit about those two options, how they came about and why they never happened, and why instead the treaty happened. Because it was the treaty that really gave birth to New Zealand, more or less as we know it today, as part of the international community. Now, there were a whole lot of people that played a part in developing this, and I don't plan to dwell on them all. But there are some names that stand out, and the person I just want to start with is a man called James Busby. Any of you descended from him? No, he has descendants in New Zealand. The ones I know of live on the East Coast, and there are probably others as well. Busby's a point, perhaps a starting point. He was a man who joined the civil service in England. In the time we're talking about, the 1830s, the biggest government department in Great Britain was the Colonial Office. It was a huge department, and its job was to look after the British colonies all around the world. Britain, of course, had established in those days, the British Empire was a huge structure with colonies in all around the globe, and the Colonial Office used to look after them. That was their job, to administer the colonies. Busby worked in the Colonial Office and managed to get a job in New South Wales as an assistant to the Governor of New South Wales. Now, he didn't get on with his boss. They argued constantly, and one of the things they argued about was New Zealand. The Governor of New South Wales in those days, one of his jobs was to keep an eye on New Zealand,
provide information to the colonial office about who was going to New Zealand and who was coming, and how many convicts escaped and left Australia and went to New Zealand, and how many didn't come back. And Busby thought that the information that was being sent to England gave the wrong picture about New Zealand. So he thought that if Britain wanted to know about New Zealand, the best way of knowing about it was to send someone there. So he went back to London, managed to get himself recalled to the colonial office. While he was there, he proposed that there should be a British resident in New Zealand, someone who would report directly to the colonial office instead of going through New South Wales. He wrote out a job description. He was the only applicant. And before he knew where he was, he had secured himself a job in New Zealand as the British resident. Now, if you read the books, they will tell you that Busby was an absolute failure. He never did anything that his job description said he was supposed to do. He was supposed to keep the peace between the tribes and the settlers. Well, the reverse happened. It got worse, not better. He was supposed to keep the peace between the tribes. Well, that was an impossible task. It would not be much easier today, but it was very difficult then. And he failed to do that. And he was supposed to keep law and order, and he didn't do that. He couldn't do that. There was no British law in New Zealand in 1835, and so he had no way of keeping the law. And he didn't have any guns, he didn't have a police force, so he couldn't impose might on anyone. All he had was moral persuasion, and he was expected to appeal to the better sentiments of people to get them to live alongside each other. And he wasn't able to do that. But more than anyone else, it was Busby that contributed to the development of the Treaty of Waitangi. I suspect, had he not been British resident in New Zealand, New Zealand's future would have been very, very different. Now, one of the first things he did when he came to New Zealand, in 1834, he called all the chiefs together and said, what you guys need is a flag. You need a New Zealand flag. And the reason he argued that was that even in 1834, ships were being built in the northern part of New Zealand, and those ships were sailing around the Pacific, including to Australia. And the question came up, if they sailed out of New Zealand, what flag should they fly? They were built in New Zealand, they left New Zealand, what flag? And Busby thought that they should fly a New Zealand flag. But there wasn't a New Zealand flag. So he called the chiefs together, 34 or 35 chiefs, and said to them, we need a flag. The chief said, do we? Not sure why, but Busby said, oh yes, if you go into international waters, you need a flag. And then he asked the chiefs to select a flag. And to make their task easier, he said, would you like to select this flag? And the chiefs said, well, we like the colours. We'll go with it. So this became, and you'll recognise it, of course, is the Cross of St. George in the middle, which was very much part of the British naval tradition. And a small ensign in the corner. He looked up and saw the Southern Cross and put four stars in there, and that became the flag that was to distinguish New Zealand as a modern nation. Remember, this is an important event. It's the first time anyone has considered New Zealand as a nation, and Busby's doing it by suggesting a flag as a symbol of nationhood. So the chiefs then agreed that this would be the flag. And ships that were built in New Zealand sailed with this flag. It was never our official flag. It later became the flag of the Shaw Savile Shipping Line, It was their flag. They liked the design too and took it away years to come. We didn't have the current flag of New Zealand until the 1860s. That's when our official flag came. But this was the unofficial flag. The significance of it was the first act of nationhood that would distinguish New Zealand as a modern state. So Busby was quite pleased that he had managed to persuade 34 chiefs to agree on a flag. It was, I understand, the only option put to them. But the next year, he called the chiefs together again, the same chiefs, virtually one or two more, and invited them to sign a document. And the document was called the Declaration of Independence. And this was signed in 1835. Now, the Declaration was a simple document, but what it made four very important points. And the first point it made was that New Zealand was independent. It wasn't part of Great Britain, it wasn't part of America, it wasn't part of France, and especially it wasn't part of New South Wales. So that's the first point he makes. New Zealand's independent. The second point that he made was that the sovereignty of New Zealand lies with the chiefs who represent their tribes. In 1835, this was a radical statement, because in those days, the colonizing powers, whether they be France or Spain or Great Britain, tended not to recognize indigenous people as having sovereignty. The old way of colonizing a country was that you walked into a country, put up your flag, and proclaimed sovereignty. Now, here's Busby taking quite a radical approach for his time by saying that in New Zealand, the sovereignty lies with the indigenous people, with Māori. A radical statement in its time. He was ahead of his time, Busby. Although Britain's views on indigenous people was beginning to change, and this was part of the change. The third point he made in the Declaration was that every year the chiefs will meet together to pass laws. He was prescribing a Māori parliament made up of the chiefs of New Zealand. And when I said earlier on that one option for New Zealand's development was as a Māori nation, this is where it came from. Busby had prescribed a Māori parliament, the chiefs would run the country, pass the laws, make the regulations, and he then prescribed a role for Britain, which was to act as a protector. Not to take it over, but to work alongside the chiefs to help them in international affairs, principally, but also to help them with the administration of the country. So this then was the first prescription for New Zealand's future, an independent state, its own parliament made up of the chiefs, who were the sovereigns of the country, and Britain would act to help it. Now, very few people signed this. 35, 36 chiefs signed it. Most tribes didn't know it existed, and maybe didn't worry too much. But it was sent to London, to the Colonial Office. The Colonial Office recognised it. The Parliament in Britain recognised it for what it said. And the King of England, who was then William IV, he was the uncle to Queen Victoria, and he died a couple of years after this, and Queen Victoria succeeded him. King William sent back a letter saying that Britain is pleased to act as a protector of this infant state and recognises the sovereignty of the chiefs. So quite a major statement from Britain. Britain trying to make up for its bad record of colonisation in the past. It was trying to turn things around a bit and to begin to have a more understanding attitude to native peoples. So the importance of this then is that even though it was signed by relatively few chiefs, 35, it's hard to know how many chiefs there were then. We know now there are how many chiefs there are. There's 500,000. But But probably, if you judge by the number of chiefs who signed the treaty, there probably were around 600 people who would have been regarded as chiefs. 35 signed the Declaration of Independence. So you couldn't say it was sort of a unanimous decision. Britain didn't know that. So Britain accepted it for what it said, recognised Maori sovereignty, and then Britain's then approach to the treaty is, well, we'll work with these people to help them get going, to look after them internationally, to help them with their trading arrangements, and to do what we can to support them. Well, of course, it never happened. The Congress, the Parliament that Busby prescribed, never actually met. And in the end, Britain didn't act as a protector, but it took over the sovereignty. Now, one of the questions comes up, why did Busby write this? What was behind it? What was his motivation? And there are two theories about it. One is that, it's probably not the right one, but Busby had an assistant, a man called Mac Donnell, and Mac Donnell worked further north than Busby did. And Mac Donnell had a great belief that you could trace all the evils of the modern world to two things. One was whiskey and the other was rum. And he passed a law which said that north of what is now Kawakawa, there will be no rum and no whiskey. I take it that beer was all right, wine was okay, sherry was fine, but no rum or whiskey. Now, when Busby heard about it, he was extremely annoyed, not because he disagreed with the sentiments, but because who was Mac Donnell to pass a law? And Mac Donnell had no authority. Britain had no authority to pass laws in New Zealand. And yet here was his 2IC, his second in command, passing a law. So instead of sending him a memo which said, Mr. Mac Donnell, you've exceeded your brief, next time you do it, you've lost your job, some people say he constructed the Declaration of Independence as a very elaborate way of pointing out to Mac Donnell that no one has the right to pass laws in New Zealand except the chiefs, because they have the sovereignty. Well, that's one possibility. It seems an elaborate way of telling your offsider that he's made a mistake. But the other reason may have had to do with a Frenchman called Baron de Thierry. Are any of you descended from the Baron? Because, well, he travelled widely. both within New Zealand and within the Pacific. He was an entrepreneurial sort of guy, and he knew he was important, but he couldn't find anyone else to recognise that. So he gave himself the title of Baron, and he came down to the Pacific in search of a kingdom. He had the credentials, he was a king, all he needed was a kingdom. And he went to Samoa and was asked to continue his voyage. Went to Tahiti, of course, where France was quite well established, and the French authorities said to him, you're just stirring up mischief. Went to Tonga and proposed that he might become the king, and they said, oh, thank you, but we already have one. And came to New Zealand. And he had let it be known, and Busby intercepted the message, that he had purchased 400,000 acres of land in the Hokianga Harbour area, and he was coming to establish the kingdom of Hokianga, and he was to become emperor. Now, it sounds fanciful, but Busby was concerned. Busby was worried that this was absolutely contradictory to his understandings of who were the sovereigns of New Zealand. And so the other reason for the Declaration of Independence was to make it clear to the world that New Zealand has already got its sovereigns, and that is the chiefs of the tribes. And that was the effect of this, that it went to the Colonial Office. The Colonial Office formally recognised Maori sovereignty and published this on what was called the London Gazette, which went around the world, so that the world knew at that point that this was Britain's position towards New Zealand, and therefore it ought to be an international position. In other words, hands off. Don't come there and become the king. The king's already there. We don't know of all these reasons why Busby did it, except that Busby was quite a bit ahead of his time in writing this document. Had he not written it, then Britain may never have needed a treaty, because the treaty was one way of getting Maori sovereignty. They may not have needed it if they had not already recognised Maori sovereignty. But by recognising the Declaration of Independence, Britain said, yes, we recognise that the chiefs have sovereignty over their own country. Well, of course, as I said, this never happened. And instead, another option became a popular one. Britain was, in the 1830s, sitting on the fence a bit. It didn't want to do too much in New Zealand. Quite expensive to colonise New Zealand. They'd had a bad experience with the United States a quarter century or so before, where they'd lost the colony, and that had been costly. And they weren't that keen to come to New Zealand, spend a lot of money, and have another colony that might go bad. So they were sitting on the fence. And this declaration suited them quite nicely. They could be involved in New Zealand, but not have to spend a huge amount of money on it. It all would have gone like that, I suspect, were it not for another company. Oh, I just mentioned the missionaries here, because if you think that the treaty was about Maori and Pākehā relationships, it was also about Catholics and Protestants. And a huge part of the treaty background can be attributed to the missionaries who arrived here. The first missionaries here were the Church Missionary Society, that's the Church of England, in the person of Samuel Marsden, who had the unfortunate job of being the chaplain to the prison colonies in New South Wales. And he found that a somewhat unrewarding job, thought that he needed a Christmas holiday, and came to New Zealand in 1814 on Christmas Day. Got here, took the first Christian service, as far as we can gather, on Christmas Day in 1814. Then realised that there were no missionaries here, and so he established the first mission station. He had brought with him another clergyman from the Church Missionary Society. They had intended to go back, but Marsden said to this unsuspecting missionary, "You had better stay here." And so that's how the first mission station was established here. It was the only one, and the Church Missionary Society, which also had tentacles all around the world, began to take a hold in New Zealand, and so that the Anglican faith was the first one promoted here. The Church of England missionaries, the Church Missionary Society, had a relatively easy job, if you can use the business analogy. They had the whole share of the market. There were no competitors, so that their business was saving souls, and they had no competition. Until the Methodists arrived, and the Methodists came shortly afterwards. But that wasn't a huge problem, because they were Protestants, and the Anglicans, after all, regarded them as an offshoot of the Anglican Church, so that was tolerated. But the real concern came when Bishop Pompallier established a Catholic mission station here. And the old antagonisms between Protestants and Catholics, which were alive and well in Europe, were transported to New Zealand. So that the Church Missionary Society missionaries began to put pressure on Britain to get more involved in New Zealand, realising that if Britain got involved, then the stamp of the Church of England was also applied to New Zealand. Remember, Queen Victoria was the head of state and the defender of the faith. So the missionaries began to encourage the chiefs to encourage Britain to be more active in New Zealand. And every time a French warship appeared off the coast, there was this terrible fear from the mission stations that the Pope might be on board. So there was this background then of growing tension between the faiths that were beginning to appear in New Zealand. Maori were rapidly converting to Christian values and to Christian beliefs, and there was beginning to be competition between the denominations. So the Church of England missionaries then, quite influential in the colonial office, send the message back to London, get a bit more involved in New Zealand. Now the Britain's sitting on the fence, but Britain began to change its attitude in 1838, 1839, and it had to do with another company that appeared called the New Zealand Company. Sometimes it's called the New Zealand Association, New Zealand Land Company, it's got various names. This had been a group that arose first of all in the 1820s. They were prominent philanthropists in England who wanted to help the poor people of Great Britain, principally Liverpool. In those days, if you were poor in Liverpool, you were really poor and could not move out of that class. And here was a chance, they argued, for them to come to New Zealand, buy a little bit of land, and establish a new way of life. It was an escape from the drudgery of Liverpool. And the idea of the company, the association, it was a not-for-profit organisation, it was a charitable organisation, and it would help immigrants come to New Zealand, it would help purchase land here, and help them get established into a new way of life. Well, it fizzled out. It didn't come to anything. If you want to be really charitable, apparently you do need some money, and they didn't have any money. They had a great deal of goodwill, but didn't have the money. So it didn't go anywhere until 1838, when it came out under new management. And the new manager was a man called Edward Gibbon Wakefield, and his approach to it was quite different. He no longer was talking about a charitable institution, but he was seeing this as a profit-making opportunity. So when the company re-emerged in 1838, it was no longer based on helping the poor, but on making a profit. Edward Gibbon Wakefield had thought this through very carefully, and he had the opportunity to think it through very carefully, because for the 3 years prior to this, he had been in jail with very little to do but read about New Zealand. And he was an interesting man. You may find yourself in this description, I hope not. But he believed that it should be possible to get rich without working. And he wasn't a wealthy, he was from a reasonably well-off but not a wealthy family of Britain. And if you weren't wealthy in Britain, you probably had to work to get wealthier. But he and his brother thought there was a terrible injustice about this, that they were born slightly on the wrong side of the tracks, didn't believe they ought to work to get rich. And they hit on a scheme that would give them wealth without working. I don't know any of you have tried it, but it was that if you want to get rich quickly and you don't want to work, then marry someone who's got some money. And they did it together. Edward Gibbon Wakefield was a little more handsome than his brother Jermingham and said to be a little more romantic. And so he went through with a marriage to a very wealthy woman. The three of them went to the Riviera in France. The brother, of course, was the manager of the marriage. The wife died under mysterious circumstances 2 years later. No one ever knew the cause of death. And they squandered her money. Didn't know how to manage the money. Came back to London and said, well, it worked once, let's have another go. By now the criteria were a little more clearer in their minds, and I'll just pass it on to you in case you want to follow the advice. If you want to marry for money, what you do is you find someone who's an only child, You don't want to share the family fortune with a whole lot of brothers and sisters. You find someone whose parents are a bit older so that you don't have to wait too long to inherit the whole estate. And you find someone who doesn't know her own mind. And they found the perfect person, a 17-year-old girl who was an only child. Her parents were older, didn't know her own mind, and they took her to France. Sent back a letter to the parents saying that if you don't make over a marriage contract and a marriage dowry, your daughter will be permanently shamed. That was in the days when you could actually shame people. I suspect now that if fathers receive that letter, they may not be too worried. But then, of course, it was an absolutely terrible thing to be living in sin. And this was a prominent English family, and the thought of their daughter being shamed was too much. So they actually had good contacts with the French police. The French police picked up the Wakefields. They both went on trial. Edward Gibbon Wakefield went to jail. While he was in jail, he began to change tactics. He still was interested in not working too much, but realised that he might have to work a little. Began to read about New Zealand and the New Zealand company that didn't come to anything in 1820, and hit on the idea that the other way of making a fortune quickly and working a little bit was to come to New Zealand, buy it cheaply, and sell it at a profit. And that was basically the intention of the company. They had heard there was a lot of land in New Zealand that was there for the asking. You could pick it up for next to nothing, and you could sell it to immigrants from Britain and make a huge profit. So he reformed the company. When he got out of jail, he reformed the company, had good contacts, and got a few business people behind him, went to the government and said, we hear you're interested in going to New Zealand. Give us a charter. We'll provide all of the transport. We'll handle the purchasing of land on your behalf, and we'll take the profit. And the British government said, that's fine by us. And they wrote out a charter for the New Zealand company, which gave them that right. At the bottom of the charter, they had a little clause which said, we want some money up front for the goodwill. Now, the New Zealand Land Company didn't like that. They said, well, why should we pay the British government anything? Then realised that they didn't need the government, and formed the view in 1839 that they would just come to New Zealand, start buying land, and if the question of ownership and governance came up, they would simply establish a republic. So the cowboys then were launched and were coming to New Zealand, whether the government approved or not. They were coming without the government's blessing, and if they had to form a republic, that's what they would do. So remember at the beginning I said New Zealand had two options for development. There was the Maori Nation, Declaration of Independence, and here was the other option, that a sort of republic would just spring up as more settlers arrived. Well, the British government was extremely annoyed about this. They felt that in recognising the Declaration of Independence, they had also promised to protect Maori interests. And here was a group of British subjects coming to New Zealand to do the opposite, to buy the land as cheaply as possible. So the government within was, the British government was worried about what was happening and realised that it had contributed to this situation. Decided then in 1839 that the government would also come to New Zealand and intervene in a much more active way than just sitting on the fence, which it was tending to do. They decided also that they would appoint a consul to New Zealand who would come over and negotiate a treaty with the chiefs. The purpose of the treaty was to negotiate a deal where the sovereignty that the chiefs had would be passed to the Crown, the British government, so that the British government could then protect them. Britain argued this way: if we can establish British law in New Zealand, we will be able to protect Maori interests. If there's no law there, we can't do anything about it. So it was sort of, you give us your sovereignty so that we can protect you. And Hobson was appointed to that task. Hobson was at a disadvantage. The New Zealand Land Company left England in August 1839. Hobson didn't get underway till October. There was a race, as it were, for New Zealand. Hobson was delayed. His wife had their fourth baby on the way over. And when she got to Sydney, she said, enough's enough. I want to pick up a bit of napsan and other things that are needed. And so she insisted on a break in New South Wales, and they spent 3 weeks there. Quite an important 3 weeks, because Hobson went to an auction while he was in Sydney and discovered that what was being auctioned was thousands and thousands of New Zealand acres. No one knew who owned the land, but it was being auctioned in Sydney, and people who purchased it would have the belief that it was to be their land. So he realised that he ought to start moving quickly, otherwise there'd be nothing left. What with the New Zealand Land Company purchasing land, these sharks trading land in New South Wales. So he had a discussion with the governor of New South Wales. The governor immediately promoted him to lieutenant governor of New Zealand. That was a premature promotion, because you can't be lieutenant governor over something you don't own. But obviously Hobson had presumed that the chiefs would agree to the deal. He then came to New Zealand in the period of, in January of 1840, arrived here the last week of January, had an argument with the captain of the ship on his way out. The captain wouldn't recognise him as lieutenant governor, he would only recognise him as a consul. He thought that all of this was being rushed, and that by rushing it, Hobson was bending the law a little. And so Captain Nias on the boat never recognised Hobson as lieutenant governor. When they arrived at the Bay of Islands, the ship anchored. The tradition then was that because the Queen's representative was on board, you fire a salute, so many guns. And when they got to 11 guns, which is what a consul gets, the captain ordered his men to stop firing. Hobson demanded that they carry on firing till they hit 15 guns, which is what a lieutenant governor gets. A governor would get 21 guns. So when Hobson ordered his men to keep firing, the captain then said to the men, "I'm the captain of the ship. Hobson may have a higher rank. I'm the captain of the ship. If you fire one more shot, you'll be charged with mutiny." And the men thought it over and said, "I think we'll leave it at 11. But it was an indication of Nias's, the captain's, concern about the haste of all of this, and his concern that Hobson was just pushing it a bit too quickly and wasn't observing the correct conventions. Anyway, they got here, and Hobson immediately made contact with William Colenso, who operated the first printing press in New Zealand and who was attached to one of the Church Missionary Society mission stations. And he asked Colenso to get out a fax to all the tribes, advising them that a meeting was to be held on the 5th of February to meet Captain Hobson and to talk about a treaty. Now, Colenso got that out. A notice went to the northern tribes. It didn't go beyond that. And then Hobson realised that he had invited these people to come and talk about a treaty. He'd better write one. There was no treaty at that point. So on the 2nd of February, he began writing the treaty. Sent the first draft over to Busby. Busby had a look at it, made some corrections, added Article 2, sent it back to Hobson. Hobson had a headache. He gave it to his secretary, a man called Freeman, and Freeman tidied it up. So those three men, Hobson, Busby, and Freeman, wrote the treaty in 2 days. If you're working on an international treaty, that probably is just a little bit too hasty to put it all together. Anyway, it wasn't from scratch. Busby had had some good instructions earlier on, Hobson had had some instructions earlier on. Anyway, at 4 o'clock on the 4th of February, the treaty had been written. And just as well, because some 800 tribes, not 800, 800 people had arrived or were arriving to talk about it. So Hobson was quite pleased that he had got it done in such a short time. And he could see the smoke going up on the shore as the people were gathering and cooking meals. There were a whole lot of canoes coming in with large numbers of people on them for the discussion. Some of them were curious about Hobson's ship, so they came quite close to it. And Hobson was fascinated by them and leaned over, and he could hear them chanting as they were making progress towards the shore. And then he realized that they weren't chanting in English. they were chanting in a language he didn't understand. And in this rather late hour, wondered whether they would ever understand the English version of the treaty that he had just written, and figured that they probably wouldn't. So at 4 o'clock that afternoon, he sent the document over to Henry Williams, one of the missionaries, and asked him to translate it and have it ready for the meeting the next morning. Now, Williams was rushed. He said yes, he could probably do it. He would have liked to have given it a bit more thought, but he'd have a go at doing it. But he did it so badly that you and I have to have this meeting today, because what he translated was a document that was in opposition to the one that Hobson had drafted. It wasn't just a minor mistake. There was a major error in it. Hobson had no way of knowing that, of course, and he thanked Williams profusely for translating it. 9 o'clock the next morning, the meeting got underway, the 5th of February, and a very formal occasion. The naval officers were dressed in full naval uniform. There were flags flying on this big marquee that had been erected. Hobson looked resplendent in the uniform of a consul. Captain Nias was there with a sword at his side, so it was quite a spectacular event. 800 people there at the meeting, not all of them in the marquee, some waiting outside. About 200 settlers were there. The church missionaries were there in large numbers. So it was quite a major event that was proposed, that was happening. Hobson had a table in the front, and he asked Williams to translate for him. The settlers, there were about 200 of them at the meeting, were opposed to that. They didn't think that Williams was a very good translator and thought that he might deliberately skew things. The settlers, by the way, were against the treaty, because they realised that once this treaty was signed, the laws of England would apply, and that's why they'd come 12,000 miles to get away from the laws of England. So they weren't too happy. They also knew they wouldn't be able to buy land directly. They'd have to go through the crown. So the settlers were by and large unhappy about it. And they said, we don't want Williams translating it. We've got our own translator. And so they put up one of their own to act as the official translator. But he was drunk and he fell down and wasn't able to do the job. So Williams carried on. Too much whiskey and rum, but Williams... Williams carried on as the translator. And the discussion got underway, and Williams introduced Hobson, read out the Maori version, said the discussion was mainly about land. The key issue of the treaty wasn't land, it was sovereignty. That wasn't actually discussed. The issue was land. The chiefs, by and large, were opposed to it. They got up one by one in very direct language, although it seems that Williams didn't translate it directly, but they would say to Hobson, go home and take Four Eyes with you, karu whā. Williams was a curiosity because he wore glasses, and they used to call him karu whā, Four Eyes. So they'd say in Māori, and Colenso did all the recording, they'd say in Māori, go home, Hobson, and take karu whā with you. Apparently Williams bended the translation a little, said they have one or two reservations, sir.
But that's how the discussion went, and it looked as if there would be no interest in a treaty, until right at the end of the day, three chiefs who were from mission stations and were quite influential chiefs stood up and put their view. Their view was that times have changed so much that the tribes need Britain to go into the new world. They trust Britain. If it's an option between Britain, France and America, all of whom had some sort of interest in New Zealand, they thought that Britain might take them the furthest, and they suggested that the treaty should be signed. But there was no agreement. And in the afternoon, as the day wore on, Hobson was astute enough to realise that the tribes didn't agree, that they hadn't reached a conclusion, and he said the meeting will come to an end and we'll continue it, not tomorrow, but we'll continue it on the 7th of February. Of course, the 6th was a holiday, it was Waitangi Day. His view was that if you have a day off, if everyone has a day off, they'll be able to think about it a bit more and come back and discuss it again on the 7th. So he retired to his ship, and so did his people. The tribes, the missionaries, and the settlers continued discussing it, so that their discussions went on well into the night. The missionaries were lobbying the chiefs to say, we think you ought to sign this. They had their own reasons for that. The settlers were lobbying the chiefs, saying, we don't think you ought to sign this, and they had their reasons for that. And come the morning, the 6th of February, the chief said, well, why wait a day? Let's get on with it. We want to talk about it more. We want to continue the meeting today. Don't need a day off. So they decided to have the meeting on the 6th of February, but forgot to tell Hobson. And Hobson was fairly annoyed about that, because here was his first instruction as consul to New Zealand, and the New Zealanders had completely disregarded it. So when he came over in dressed only partly in naval uniform and partly in civil uniform. And the reason for doing it was to point out that this wasn't a proper meeting. He had said the 7th. Everyone else had said the 6th, so he only half recognised it as a formal meeting. They were about to get underway when who should turn up but the Roman Catholic bishop, Bishop Pompallio. You may have noticed, may have heard that earlier this year his remains were returned to New Zealand for interment here. He had been buried in France, but they, because of the role he played, people wanted him back. So the bishop turns up, flowing robes, purple robes, and has a look around at the proceedings, and then says to Hobson that he suspects this whole thing is a Church of England jack-up. And he wanted to add something else to the treaty. And what he wanted added was that everyone in New Zealand should be free to choose their own religion, and Maori custom should be respected. Now, sometimes that's called the fourth article of the treaty. Sometimes it's called the protocol clause. But it was read out at Waitangi, but never written into the treaty. So the bishop Pompallio, just a little concerned, again about the same point that Nias was concerned, there's an element of rush in all of this. So Hobson agreed to that. He agreed to the protocol clause, and then said, let's get on with it. And as he was about to get on with it, he then said, no more discussion. Because this isn't a proper meeting, the only thing you can do today is sign the treaty. I won't allow any discussion on it. Now, I've been at a number of meetings where the chairman has exercised the chairman's right, but this seemed to be just a little unusual and a little hard to follow, that Hobson denied any discussion and simply said, come and sign the treaty. When he said that, Colenso, who was faithfully recording everything, confronted Hobson and said, the people you're asking to sign this treaty have no idea what the treaty's about. Colenso knew that the big issues hadn't even been talked about. Land wasn't the main issue. Sovereignty was the issue. Never raised. Hobson's reply to him was that if they don't understand what they're about to sign, it will be your job in future years to make it clear to them. So he passed that over to the church, that the church had an obligation to explain the treaty. And then he got underway. Hobson was increasingly irritated. He had high blood pressure, at least that's my guess. He had a stroke in March, a minor stroke, and then he died in 1842 at quite a young age, and I suspect he had a cerebral hemorrhage then. So, and he used to complain of headaches all the time. So I suspect he had high blood pressure, and he was irritable. So once he had put Colenso in his place and said, your job is to tell people in years to come the meaning of what they've just signed, he then invited the chiefs to come and sign the treaty. And the first three up were the three that had agreed the night before, and they stepped forward and signed. As each one signed, he shook their hand, said, "He iwi kotahi tato, we are one people," gave them two blankets and a small quantity of tobacco, make sure they didn't live too long. Then this thing called whanaungatanga took over. Whanaungatanga is a process which basically means that if your uncle or auntie tell you to do something and you want to keep reasonably healthy, you'll probably say yes, uncle, or yes, auntie. And so these three chiefs that came up and signed were very influential. All they needed to do was to nod under the direction of their nephew or to nod in the direction of a cousin, and that nephew or cousin knew that they would have to come up and sign the treaty. If you're dealing with the tribes, you need to link into this whanaungatanga pretty well and make sure you find out who auntie is and get her on your side. Otherwise, you're in trouble. So gradually people came up and signed. At the end of the day, there were 46 people who had signed, and Hobson thought, well, that's not too bad. Called it a day. So they were going to have some celebrations the next day on the 7th of February, but it rained, and they had to cancel them. And on the 8th, they actually had the celebrations, but by then everyone had gone home. So they simply fired a few rockets up from the ship to mark the first Waitangi celebration. They've had trouble at Waitangi ever since then, getting the format right for the celebrations. But it sort of fizzled out a little bit there. But what happened then was that the treaty was taken to 43 other places in the country and signed there. So the signing didn't actually finish till September. Taken all around the country. The missionaries took it, quite a lot of them, and some government officials took it. And they travelled the whole country with the Treaty of Waitangi. They didn't go everywhere. Some tribes were missed out. Rangitane and Palmerston North and the Manawatū were missed out. They were never asked, do you want to sign the treaty or not? The man who was taking it down there was Henry Williams, and he was travelling on the coast, and he left a note in his diary to say he stopped at the mouth of the Manawatū River, but no one was home. The problem was home was 30 miles up the river. And so Rangitane were never invited to sign it. The Tūhoe tribe in the Uruweras never signed the treaty. Not that they opposed it, but no, they missed the turnoff, I suspect, when they were when they were travelling into the Bay of Plenty. Some tribes refused to sign. The two big tribes in the middle of the North Island, that's the Te Arawa tribe at Rotorua and the Tūwharetoa tribe around Lake Taupo, wouldn't sign. And when the missionary came there, they had a couple of objections. One was that if this is so important, and if this is a treaty between the tribes and the Queen of England, where's the Queen? They don't send third-level management to talk to me. I'm a chief. I want to talk to the other chief. And so they wouldn't. They didn't like the style. They felt there was a lack of respect there. The other problem that Tūwharetoa had was that it was a queen and not a king. They would have been much more comfortable doing business with a king. I think they still have that inclination to some extent. And so do their cousins in Te Arawa. Well, because Te Wharetoa wouldn't sign, their cousins Te Arawa said, we won't sign either. So here you've got two large groups, asset-rich tribes, not signing. Some tribes signed in a conditional way, and today we would say they had signed a memorandum of understanding. Well, the Waikato tribe from here, for example, the paramount chief Te Wharewhero, who became the first Maori king, refused to sign the treaty. But he thought, what say there's something in it and we miss out? So he had no objection to 39 other chiefs signing it at Port Waikato. His argument was, if we sign it, we're saying we're interested, but if I withhold my signature, we're not totally committed. It's today we would call that an expression of interest. That you want to be involved in it, but you're not ready to make an absolute commitment to it. It was so subtle that it was lost on the British. But of course, within Maori politics, it meant a huge thing that the paramount chief had not signed it. On the east coast, there was another paramount chief, Te Kanea Takiro, took the same approach. He said to William Williams, who was the missionary who took it there, brother to Henry Williams, and the father of his daughter married Busby, but I won't go into the domestics of all of this. When William Williams took the treaty to the east coast, Te Kanea Takiro said, come to my house and sign it. I won't sign it myself if you don't mind, but the others will sign it. Now, he had the same belief that by not signing it, he was protecting his tribe in case it went wrong. And today we would say he was interested in discussing it further, but not ready to make an absolute commitment. One of our people signed it twice, Te Rauparaha. You may have heard of him. He was quite good with a gun. And it was always better to be on his side than on the other side. So when Henry Williams went to Wellington, he made a straight line for Te Rauparaha's, and Te Rauparaha agreed to sign the treaty. And then the man who did the South Island, when he came back from the South Island, he approached Te Rauparaha as well and asked him to sign it. Te Rauparaha said, you know, I'm sure I've signed this jolly thing before, but signed it anyway. Some of our relatives say that he really only wanted the four blankets. His name appears twice. Five women signed it, only five. The missionaries who took it round, as women came up to sign, were discouraged because in Britain at that time, women were chattels of their husband and didn't sign important things like a Treaty of Waitangi. So he would discourage women. One or two broke through. Te Rauparaha's sister, for example, signed the treaty. She was actually the mastermind of his whole operations, managed the whole campaign, an extremely strategic thinker, a great mind, a powerful woman, and a smart woman. She would send him out with the guns, tell him where to go, and she would stay at home. But she signed it, and so did four other women. And at the end of the day, at the end of September, there were something like 510 signatures. Now, Hobson rushed it all. Here was a process that was taking its time but proceeding with some sort of logic, even though it was a little bit hit and miss as to who signed it. Hobson rushed it. He, on the May the 21st of 1840, he proclaimed sovereignty over New Zealand. Remember, the treaty wasn't signed until September. On May the 21st, he proclaimed sovereignty over the whole of New Zealand, and he said, I'm proclaiming sovereignty over the North Island because there is universal agreement with the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, that was a fairly flawed statement. First of all, most tribes had not by then decided whether they wanted to sign it or not, and he ignored completely the opposition to it from the two big tribes in the centre of the island. And in the case of the South Island, he used a different approach to taking sovereignty. Is anyone here from Ngaitahu? Yeah, I might just have to reword this slightly. Well, perhaps not, because what he wrote in his proclamation was that he's taking the North Island because there's universal agreement with the Treaty of Waitangi. That was a flawed statement. And I'm taking the South Island because the natives, by right of discovery, not through the treaty, but by right of discovery, because the natives of the South Island are not sufficiently intelligent to understand a treaty. That was how he was wording it. Now, while he was doing that, his offsider, Major Bunbury, was in the South Island negotiating the treaty with the people down there. And in fact, the South Island was taken twice, once by right of discovery, and then in June, Major Bunbury took sovereignty over the South Island on the basis of agreement with the Treaty of Waitangi. So Hobson rushed it a bit in May. The reason he rushed it, apparently, is that a French warship had arrived in Auckland in April and was heading for the South Island, and the rumour was that France was going to take the South Island. There's no evidence for it, but that was the rumour. And Hobson wanted to rush it. The other thing that made him rush it was that one of his men went to Wellington and was kidnapped by the Wakefields. Well, he used the word kidnapped. It may not have been quite like that. And while this person was in captivity, he claims that he overheard the New Zealand Land Company directors talking about establishing the Republic of Wellington. And Hobson, rightly or wrongly, thought that he had to act quickly to cut that off. So he rushed the gun a bit, took sovereignty over New Zealand, sent the message to London. The message arrived back. I'll just rush through this because I think he put the message to London. The London Gazette published this message that Britain has taken sovereignty over New Zealand. The effect of that is saying to France, hands off New Zealand. America, hands off New Zealand. It's a British position. Immediately, this is the dark chapter in New Zealand's history, we were governed from New South Wales. The only arrangements they could make was that New Zealand became a dependency of New South Wales, and the governor of New South Wales was the governor of New Zealand. Hobson wasn't the first governor, the governor of New South Wales was. There's a Trivial Pursuits question in the New Zealand edition on that one. Everyone thinks it's Hobson. It's Governor Gipps, by the way. Anyway, that only lasted until the following year. In 1841, New Zealand became a crown colony. That is, it was governed by the British Parliament. In 1854, we established our own parliament, so we became a self-governing colony, still pretty much under the direction of Great Britain. 1903, we became a dominion, no longer a colony. And in 1947-46, we accepted the Statute of Westminster, which gave us much more independence from Great Britain. And in 1986, but not until 1986, we became an independent country. So that, and by independent I mean it is now impossible for Great Britain to intervene in any New Zealand law or any New Zealand policies. Not that they want to. Their interests have switched entirely to Europe and the European community. They won't take our lamb anymore. They wouldn't defend us when France was letting bombs off on the Mururoa Atoll. Remember, Great Britain would not come out and oppose that, because in opposing it, they would have to criticise their neighbours, France, and they needed the French money, the French franc, more than they needed the New Zealand dollar. So Britain has increasingly moved away from New Zealand anyway, and in 1986 we passed in New Zealand an Act of Parliament. Geoffrey Palmer put it through Parliament, which now makes us an absolutely independent country, but still part of the British Commonwealth. When Queen Elizabeth comes here, she doesn't come here as the Queen of Great Britain. She comes here as the Queen of New Zealand. So she's our head of state. It's unusual that she lives 12,000 miles away, and New Zealand's probably the night job rather than the full-time job. But she doesn't come here as the Queen of England. She comes here as the Queen of New Zealand. So our links with Britain are strong. We retain the same monarch, even though she wears a different hat when she comes here. retain the same monarch, but we are now an independent country. And then the question that we now face is that this was our beginning. You can see how the significance of the treaty to the beginning of New Zealand as a modern state. And the question ahead of us is, where now does the treaty sit in the future development of New Zealand? I've rushed through this period of our history. It's only a five-year period, and a huge amount was happening. Most of it, by the way, on the other side of the world. The tribes were by and large unaware of what was being planned for them. This was well before the Resource Management Act and the requirement to consult that came much later. So all of this was sort of happening around the tribes rather than them having any direct input into it. But the net effect was that New Zealand emerged into the modern world as a colony of Great Britain, and that's how we were born into the international community, not as a Maori nation, not as a republic. Interestingly enough, those two debates are still run from time to time. Ken Mayer, quite in favour of establishing the Maori nation, and the Prime Minister, quite in favour of a republic, apparently. So we're obviously going to have these debates again, but between 1835 and 1840, they were quite major issues. Now, I thought we might just have a break, not for lunch. It's a little early for lunch, but if we just have a break for a few minutes, because before lunch, I just want to read the treaty through with you so that for once in your life you can say you've actually heard the treaty and know what the words are. Most people who are great commentators about the treaty have never actually read it. So why don't we break for a few minutes, and then I'll do that, then we could break for lunch.